Leslie J. Lippenberry, National Department of Justice, representing the Eagles Incorporated. Charles S. Eagle, Leslie Hendricks, plaintiff's counsel. Stuart A. Raphael, Alexander B. Cunningham.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Leslie Kendrick. I teach at the University of Virginia School of Law, and I represent the plaintiff, Mr. Wesley Quisenberry, personal representative of his mother, Wanda Quisenberry, deceased. If I may, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal, please.
All right. Thank you.
As you know, Your Honors, this case comes to you on certification from the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Virginia, where Mr. Quisenberry's negligence action against the defendant is pending after removal from the state court. At issue today is one issue, a fundamental principle of Virginia tort law. Defendants and their actions owe a duty of care to classes of persons within the scope of danger of their negligent acts.
Is there, counsel, if it's so fundamental, as you say, is there a single Virginia case that's ever extended an employer's tort duties to members of the employee's family based upon negligence arising at the employer's workplace, which would otherwise be covered entirely by comp?
Well, Your Honor, there's not a Virginia Supreme Court case, which is why we're here today. But I would note that every Virginia Circuit Court to have dealt with this issue, this specific issue of liability for asbestos exposure to family members, every one of those circuit courts but one has held that there was a duty and considered this just a garden variety negligence issue.
But if it were so fundamental, as you say, and if this court has consistently, as you say, adopted essentially a foreseeability paradigm, a third restatement, Andrews foreseeability paradigm, if that were really clear, we've gone our entire existence as a Commonwealth and never had a single case involving a member of an employee's family suing an employer for a workplace injury, which the employee, him or herself, could not sue. It seems like to me that the comp statutes, the social compact, that the treaty between capital and labor and government, and the legislature has addressed it in incredible detail. And now a tort theory has arisen that throws the quid pro quo off pretty substantially. But you say it's fundamental and it's an existing law.
Yes, Your Honor. So I would say that the principle that we've stated is there in Blackstone, where it says a noisome trade can generate a duty to people who are affected by it. It's there in air pollutant cases, toxin cases.
Well, we're talking about nuisance law, of course, at that point. That's a different subset. It's maybe analogous, but it's not the same thing as an employer's duty for negligence on the employer's work site.
So, Your Honor, in my view, opposing counsel makes some argument about this as well, the fact that there is an employment relationship concerned somewhere in this case does not obviate other tort duties that the defendant might have. If an employer were to run over his employee and the daughter of the employee, we would not say that because there's an employment relationship between the employer and the employee, that answers the question of any duty to the daughter. It doesn't. This case is exactly the same as that. And the fact that there's an employment relationship is, to a large degree, a distraction.
Well, the different situation in your hypothetical is the relational test would say, no, they ran over the employee and the daughter in the employer's parking lot with workplace negligence. There's the Paul's graph proximal relationship.
Yes, Your Honor. So just to be clear, we are not in any way endorsing the Andrews version of Paul's graph. Nothing about our claim stands or falls on the distinction between the second and the third restatement, between Andrews and Cardozo, between the settled majority and the settled minority dissent opinion, because what we would say is there's a duty of care that is relational, sir, it is relational, but it's to classes of persons, as this court has said, that are defined not by necessarily relationships. When we're talking about rescue cases, which is the bulk of what the defendant talks about and cites, when we're talking about there being a risk that was not created by the defendant, and when does the defendant have a duty to step in and protect someone against a risk the defendant didn't create? That's when we're talking about special relationships.
Well, if foreseeability is the test, why do we have a dram shop line of cases? If I'm a bartender and a guy's hanging his keys out and he's on his fifth drink, it's obviously foreseeable he poses a risk to killing somebody on the road, and yet there's no liability. So, I mean, I can give a half a dozen other easy examples of how the foreseeability paradigm can't answer all the questions.
So, Your Honor, we can call it foreseeability. We can call it relational. We're happy to use the word relational. But in cases like this, we're talking about a defendant creating a risk through their own conduct that then generates a risk to someone within the scope of harm. And the question is, who's within that scope of harm? And this court has said that's a relational question, but it's a relational question that is defined not by whether there's a relationship, let alone a contractual relationship between the parties. It's defined by the scope of the risk. This court has said in one case, it's about the juxtaposition of the risk generated by the defendant and the potential falling under that risk of the plaintiff. And
so under that theory, then you wouldn't, I mean, where would be the limitation on liability under that theory? Because would it not extend to people who are in contact with the employee's clothes, cleaning the clothes? People
yes,
who are in regular contact with the employee, is that how far you would extend it?
No, Your Honor. So precisely because it's relational, I think we have to think about what's the likelihood of exposure? What's the predictable scope of the risk? And there are going to be people, maybe people with good claims at a retail level, that fall out of that. But this is a wholesale principle. And any wholesale principle generated out of these cases, we think, would encompass family members, household members of the employee. They're the ones within the vector of the carriage of the asbestos home. And as the California court has said in Kesner, you can't catch them all. There are line drawing issues. But that doesn't mean that you foreclose liability when you do have a foreseeable class of persons who was predictably subject to this risk. And so they drew that line there, and we would be comfortable.
So suppose a doctor has a malpractice and an infant born a day earlier suffers a death as a result. Isn't it not 100% foreseeable that the birth mother is going to have an incredible emotional trauma?
Yes, Your Honor. So I would say on that, as with the dram shop that you mentioned earlier, there are specific common law rules that govern those cases. There's no specific common law rule that governs this case because no one can identify it. That's why we're here.
You argue that foreseeability is the fundamental test. It's the only paradigm. It's the overarching paradigm. And I keep testing that, and I find example after example where that can't be the overarching test.
So let me try to convince you, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. So with regard to the physician-patient relationship, there are two different issues there that are implicated in the hypothetical you give. One of them is you're talking about a pure emotional harm case, and there is a defined common law on pure emotional harm that's different from physical injury. So we're talking in our case about a garden variety negligence case where the defendant caused the risk through their own conduct, and that manifested in physical injury. The second thing that happens in the doctor-patient cases, and this is at issue in Fruderman, Your Honor, is the nature of the doctor-patient relationship itself is so special. It involves confidentiality and involves the doctor, again, not imposing the risk on the plaintiff, but having a duty to protect or treat or cure the a patient, right? So in that situation, the doctor is not necessarily going to have a duty to a third party. That could interfere with the doctor-patient relationship.
That's just a rhetorical conclusion. A doctor who says, if I'm negligent and this infant dies, the relationship between doctor and patient doesn't preclude the obvious fact that, and if it does die, the woman that just came out of the birthing room is going to be a wreck and is going to have severe traumatic a response to this.
Yes, Your Honor, but we would say that is different from a situation where the defendant's own actions caused physical injury to the plaintiff. I would point out also that the defendant relies entirely on special relationship cases in this case, which are an apposite because they're all about cases where the defendant did not create the physical risk, and the question is, when does the defendant have a duty to protect? That's when we get into special relationships. That's an entirely separate principle of Virginia tort law. I would note also the defendant's position, the logical conclusion there would be there is never a duty between an employer and a household member. Never. even if this defendant were to start using asbestos or another toxin tomorrow, by virtue of the fact that there's not a relationship between the employer and the take-home, the family member, there would never under any circumstances be a duty. That cannot be
One thing, accepting that in this particular case there is a familial relationship, what I'd like to hear your response to is how do we essentially cabin, or what is the limiting principle? I can think of all sorts of hypotheticals. What about the next door neighbor who comes over to play every single day? But the hypothetical that actually I think really does apply to this shipyard or almost any shipyard, what about the bar across the street where the workers get off, at 4 o'clock the whistle sounds, they walk across the street to the bar, and they have a beer. And there's a bartender that's been there for 30 years, and the bartender comes down with mesothelioma because every day at 4 o'clock his bar is loaded with people who are loaded with dust. Is there potentially liability there or not? And going farther than that hypothetical, where is the limiting principle?
Yes, Your Honor. It is entirely within this court's judgment to decide where that principle is, but other courts have decided that family members, household members, that's an appropriate line. I would also point out that...
Okay, I accept that argument, but have any of those courts said, well, outside of family members, here is how it is limited, or do they simply use the familial relationship as the only limiting principle?
Yes, Your Honor. So California has said household members, family members. Satterfield, the Tennessee case, has opened it up to more persons with regular, repeated, long-standing exposure. They're more comfortable with that. And I think it would be within the discretion of this court to decide where it would go. But of those is a workable... I'm sorry.
I'd like to finish the answer. You go ahead. Go ahead. I'll answer the question you have.
Oh. All right.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't know if you had finished answering my question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Why isn't... You say it's up to us, right? But yet there's been not a single case involving employer's negligence at the work site affecting an employee and then the employee's family suing. Not a single case like that in 200 years of our jurisprudence. Why isn't that fact alone a good reason to say, no, this is a public policy judgment, and the legislature needs to answer this, and they need to look at whether the Comp Act should be amended to include these scenarios, or whether it should be amended, or whether they should grant a cause of action?
Briefly, Your Honor, I would say this is a garden variety negligence principle that has been treated as such by most lower courts in the state of Virginia and Commonwealth without this creating a problem and without this being a major public policy issue. I would say also because it comes back to a fundamental principle, the defendant's act generates a duty to those within the scope of the harm. That's a standard common law principle. It would be very odd to say that the judgment on that belongs to the legislature rather than this court, and I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Ms. Kendrick, when that gets down to zero, you're going to have 5 minutes of rebuttal anyway, all right? And you'll have additional 5 minutes as a result, so don't rush yourself. One of the criticisms that's made by the defendant is that basically what you're saying is this is a duty to the world concept, either rooted in Restatement 3 or extrapolated from Restatement 2 or whatever. But their position is that foreseeability has never dictated duty under Virginia law. Can you address that before you sit down?
Yes, Your Honor, and thank you. So we're using the term foreseeability, and I think it's a little bit of a weasel word, and I don't think that it's used in Virginia in the same way that it's used in a more freewheeling state like California, where they've said, well, we don't care that much about the distinction between causing a risk through your actions and protecting people from risks that arise from other places. Virginia cares very much about that distinction, and I would point out that virtually all of the defendant's arguments are about that latter category of special relationship rescue, what I'll call rescue cases. This is not a rescue case. So this is a case involving just a pure basic principle of your acts You generate a duty of care to those within the scope of the harm, the danger. And this court has used words like scope of danger in Dudley, like juxtaposition in other cases, that get at the relational nature of that. But when you dig into it and think about, well, how do you define the scope of the harm, the scope of the risk, foreseeability is going to come into that a little bit. You're going to think about, well, you know, naturally, what would I think the risks arising from this act would be? And that's the way in which we try to use the term foreseeability, that there is some aspect of duty that's about what's the juxtaposition between this defendant's risk acts and the risk that's imposed on the plaintiff. There's some foreseeability in that, but if it's a word that creates problems, that's problematic, I hope I've described it better. It comes back to, let's define the scope of the danger.
Counsel, let me ask you this question. Doesn't it have to do with the degree of danger? For example, in contrast to an asbestos case, if you've got an anthrax manufacturer or somebody who's in a nuclear reactor, then obviously the scope of danger would be much broader, and that would define the class.
Yes, Your Honor. So I would say there's a kind of trade-off here between how many people are going to be exposed to something and how catastrophic that exposure is going to be. And it probably does turn to some extent on the type of compound or type of toxin we're talking about. So if we were talking about an industrial employer that used anthrax in its operations, I would hope we would all agree they have to take reasonable care to ensure that anthrax doesn't leave the property. Now, this looks slightly different because asbestos is a carcinogen and highly, highly harmful product, but it's the way in which the harm occurs is slightly different. It occurs through repeated exposure, through long-standing exposure, and even then, what you're looking at is a kind of a low probability risk of a very catastrophic harm for those unlucky people who will contract mesothelioma or asbestosis. So I think you're absolutely right, Your Honor.
Can I ask you one other question? This has to do with Justice Mims' question. Do we even have to do the limiting principle right now? Because it seems to me that the federal court has sort of flipped it around. What was really a 12b6 motion, they've sort of turned it into basically an all or nothing thing, that every household employee is, or household family member is now likely to have a claim. All we have to do is say that you're not barred from the courthouse in this case, don't we?
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, I think given the posture of this case, that would be the right thing to do. That to say, in the Commonwealth of Virginia, this action is not barred as a matter of law under duty principles. And when we can't say as a matter of law there's no duty, this case goes forward. There's been no factual record developed. All we have are factual allegations that have to be taken as true and that could establish that the defendant was well aware of this risk. And I think it would be a problem to say either for all asbestos plaintiffs or certainly for all industrial family member exposure cases as a whole, there's no duty on such a bare factual record.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The clerk will put 5 minutes back on for rebuttal, and the clerk will put 20 minutes on for the appellees.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, Alexandra Cunningham on behalf of Huntington Ingalls Incorporated. To go back to where Justice Kelsey started, a take-home duty is a derivative duty. The duty that is alleged here depends entirely on the fact that there is a relationship with another party. Here, it's the employer-employee relationship. The duty can only be performed or breached through that relationship, the employee-employer relationship, and the class of persons to whom the duty is owed or could be owed can only be defined through the activities and lifestyle of that other person, the employee. That is the crux of the analysis here, and it's determinative of the result under Virginia law.
May I ask you this? We just heard the examples discussed of anthrax and so on. So would that answer change in that scenario, and how is that different from this? So if I'm researching a vaccine for the bubonic plague, and I take a casual, as an employer, I take a casual approach to workplace safety, and so someone is injured in a predictable way. What would you say about that, and how is this different?
Your Honor, I think in that circumstance, there may be a heightened duty. Certainly in circumstances of ultra-hazardous chemicals, courts have in some instances found a heightened duty associated with those activities. Really, though, the ultra-hazardous exception is something that has only been applied in the relationship between sort of independent contractors to say why you might have a higher duty to different contractors on the site, and it's in relation to the activity. I think for purposes of this case, asbestos has never been determined to be an ultra-hazardous activity.
That is clearly different.
It's very different.
You know, chalk dust or
exactly.
The flour as a baker or something like that.
Right. You can work with it in a safe manner. And I think, you know, in response here, you're answering a limited question with respect to asbestos. Justice Smith.
There's no doubt that at times in the past, manufacturers have worked with it in an unsafe manner.
No question, and that's certainly not
what we're actually dealing with here. An allegation that back in the 1950s and 1960s, you would walk out of the shipyard or any number of other occupations with asbestos dust all over you.
That is the allegation here, Your Honor, but it goes back to the relationship with the employee and the employer, and there has to be a legal basis under Virginia law to have the duty here. And the reason why plaintiffs are so focused on foreseeability and trying to sort of shoehorn Virginia into a foreseeability as a determining factor jurisdiction is because, to a T almost, courts in other jurisdictions that have looked at this and have found that a duty exists have done so because foreseeability is the primary test in their duty analysis. And I think if you look at the examples that they cited to you, Tennessee, New Jersey, California, what's interesting is in those states, you don't have to dig to find a statement about the role of foreseeability. Each one of them has a clear statement within their jurisprudence that says foreseeability is our test. We don't have that in Virginia, and plaintiffs don't cite that. And in fact, we have numerous cases where this court says just the opposite. The court says foreseeability is not the test for determining duty in our court.
Foreseeability is relevant, is it not?
Well, certainly foreseeability is relevant to a negligence claim in Virginia. And I think the primary way that foreseeability comes into the analysis of a negligence claim in Virginia is in the breach and proximate cause analysis. In Virginia, we look at that relational component of the duty first, and then in breach and proximate cause is where foreseeability primarily comes in. And I think that's something that Chief Justice Kinzer made very clear in the RGR decision. Foreseeability does also, on occasion, come into this court's analysis of duties. And in that situation, it's usually to cabin or limit a duty. And so a lack of foreseeability can cut off a duty that would otherwise exist when this court determines that there's a relationship there. And so we see that in cases. For example, the Yuzovsky case is a case where you talk about that concept of using foreseeability to pull back on a duty that might have been determined based on relationship alone. But
if the law in Virginia is that general negligence principles require a person to exercise due care to avoid injuring others, and as you have just said, if foreseeability can cabin that duty, then if under the facts of this case or any asbestos case, it was clear to employers at the time when this gentleman was working at this shipyard that asbestos dust in the clothes carried home, exposing the family, could result in the family having some negative health issues. Why wouldn't that be the law of Virginia, cabined by the foreseeability of the dust impacting the family?
Well, Your Honor, I think that would essentially turn foreseeability into would mean foreseeability is the primary factor.
No, that would be foreseeability saying if there is a duty that requires a person to exercise due care to avoid injuring someone else, Virginia law. And if the someone else turns out to be a family member where the dust is tracked into the home, then the foreseeability would cabin it there, as using your term of cabining it. Wouldn't that?
But, Justice Powell, I think what that example misses is it completely removes the relational aspect of duty, which is where this court has always started the analysis. It takes out that relational component, and that's where this court has started, either from a relationship in a human sense or relational in the sense that we see, for example, in the Paulscraft case, where we're talking about a relationship in time and space. And almost to a T, that relationship in time and space is a geographic concept.
It's so those not would be a, like the automobile.
The automobile example, or really the property cases from which that general principle, Justice Powell, that you were saying, come from.
But RGR also says, counsel, the existence of this duty, the duty that I just described, does not depend on proving a particular relationship. So are you using relational in a different manner than relationship?
Well, what I think I'm saying, in a few points on RGR, what I think I'm saying with regard to that, it doesn't require proving a specific relationship, but it does require either that relational concept, and as I said, that can be in a relationship sense, a human-to-human, which I submit is the proper way and the way the court has always looked at a derivative-type duty issue, like a take-home duty issue, or the relation can be that geographic proximity sense that comes up in the automobile cases or in the RGR case where you're talking about the proximity of a lumber pile to the road.
But isn't the problem that if we say that the general rule of law is you owe a duty not to hurt people, isn't that simply a colloquial way of saying you owe a duty to all mankind?
It is, and this court is clearly has not adopted the third restatement.
That's not the petitioner's argument here.
No, it's not. No, it's not. I wasn't trying to argue that. I think they have definitely pulled away from that argument that Virginia is a duty to the world. But I think the important thing in recognizing that Virginia is not a duty to the world jurisdiction is that it, as a sort of proverbial gut check to any test or legal theory that you're applying to determine the duty, you have to be sure that the duty doesn't turn into a duty to the world.
Well, is it logical for a jury to determine whether or not the defendant owes a duty?
Well, not only is it not logical, I think it's a matter of law that the court decides that issue in Virginia.
So the first take is always going to be the judge saying, here's a boundary, we're not going over, and it doesn't matter how foreseeable it is or isn't, because there's so many examples of boundaries we've drawn where it's clearly foreseeable and it's inarguably foreseeable harm can have. So my question is, if we've never drawn this boundary, if it's not part of our precedent, if no jurisprudential theory has endorsed it directly except in parentheticals in RGR, then isn't that a public policy question for the democratic arm of government as opposed to the judiciary?
Absolutely, and I think that's exactly what we assert, that this is a question that is best left for the General Assembly. To get there under Virginia law, you would have to create a new duty. It would involve the policy line drawing that this court has said repeatedly is something that is best left for the General Assembly.
I will confess that looking for that line, and this is a problem that has to be deviled, of course, all over the United States and England, is, you know, I mean, both we have excellent briefs on both sides trying to silo Virginia law as this or that, and I found that our cases resist that characterization. So I'm just trying to figure out where to draw that line in the sense that we don't seem to have an overarching paradigm.
I would agree, and I certainly that would make this argument as I stand up here today a lot easier. I think, though, some jurisdictions do have a specific list of factors. We are not one of them, but if you look at the totality of the Virginia cases that address duty, I think we can come away with some guiding principles that lead to the result that there is no duty here. I think One, and a sort of starting point, is that this court does not create new duties. We rely on the common law. There's no presumption of duty, so we avoid anything that looks like a restatement third duty to the world. And the duty, we keep that on the plaintiff.
That's not our issue. We're not even, the restatement third isn't before us, and it's not going to be.
Okay. Well,
let me ask you this. You in your brief repeatedly invited us to back to Paul's graph.
Yes,
and I must say I took your invitation. It's the first time I've ever read Paul's graph without my heart beating faster from stress because I was worried about an exam question. I'm going to quote from it. And I'm going to quote from it in the context of the relational aspect that you have, that's central to your argument. The risk reasonably to be perceived defines the duty to be obeyed, and risk imports relation. It is risk to another or to others within the range of apprehension. Here's the key that I want you to respond to. This does not mean, of course, that one who launches a destructive force is always relieved of liability if the force, though known to be destructive, pursues an unexpected path. And as I kind of cogitated on the eloquence of Judge Cardozo, we are here because of an unexpected path. We are here because of a little girl sitting on her daddy's lap. And he indicates that you are not relieved of liability because of that. So,
I hesitate to say that I know exactly what Justice Cardozo was saying there. But I think that the takeaway.
You elevated him, but he.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right.
I apologize. No, that's okay. But I think that in that case, the takeaway is that there is this relational concept of duty by time and space. And I think
you specifically kept the door open to the unexpected path?
I don't think that's necessarily anything different than what's being discussed in the case otherwise. And I guess the New York Court of Appeals in the In Re New York City asbestos litigation case, which was where New York decided this take-home duty case, mm-hmm. and looked back to Paul's graph and maybe can do a better job of saying what Judge Cardozo was saying there. In that case, in finding that no take-home duty existed, the New York Court of Appeals, interpreting its own law, which as we point out in our briefs, was decided partially on Virginia law and certainly followed by Virginia after, said that you have to look at the relational aspect of duty. Foreseeability, as the Paul's graph concept goes, is used to limit that duty after you've established the relational duty. And that's what the New York Court of Appeals said in recent years is what Paul's graph means and what that means. And I would submit to this court, when you're looking at, or if you're looking at, the cases from other jurisdictions, because obviously...
Counsel, can I interrupt you a second and ask you about a case from our jurisdiction? Let me ask you about Dudley.
Yep.
And in Dudley, we talk about the restatement second, and we talk about Section 281. And in there we say that in certain circumstances, a duty to an entire class of prospective victims, those who are directly and foreseeably exposed to the risk of bodily harm, as a result of the defendant's failure. Isn't that what we've got here? It's a relational situation. Certainly there's no relationship between the victim in that case and the defendant. There's not a geographical relationship. It's a relational situation because of the circumstances, the juxtaposition of the parties. Isn't that what we have here?
Your Honor, respectfully, I don't think that's what we have here. The relational component, even in the Dudley case, if we look at the actual facts of the Dudley case, which really started, I think, from the restatement section 319 duty in that case, which is the duty to take, or where you take charge of someone who is potentially dangerous. And so it's starting from this assumption almost of a duty The duty doesn't exist unless you've already started that process by taking charge. And then the way the court in Dudley...
Well, we said in Kellerman, once you take charge of that duty, once you assume the duty, then you have the duty.
Well, when you take charge of that duty, yes. When you voluntarily assume the duty...
And the analysis is the same once you've assumed it, isn't it?
Well, I'm not sure I'm understanding. Once you assume the duty, I think what...
I think you're trying to draw a distinction between assuming a duty and not. But we have said in Kellerman that there's no distinction, really. Once you've assumed the duty, you've got the duty on you.
But I don't think in the instance or in the take-home exposure scenario, moving it back to our specific fact pattern, the employer hasn't assumed the duty to the person at home. There is no voluntary assumption of the duty. In fact, we say there is no duty. And so I think that's what distinguishes Dudley, and it really is because of that restatement section 319 provision.
But does the assumption of the duty doctrine apply unless you first conclude that there is no duty? In other words, we don't even go to the assumption of the duty doctrine until there's no coercive duty required by common law or statute. Otherwise, it's an irrelevant concept. You assume a duty only because it's
because
not there.
Because there is no duty, yeah. Right. And I think that's another point that's made in Dudley, and that's how Dudley distinguishes itself from, for example, the Fox case.
There'd be no doubt here that if there were no pre-existing duty, but they nonetheless assumed a duty and made an effort at protecting the family members,
right,
but negligently did that, then of course they didn't have a duty, but they assumed it and they were held to a standard of reasonable care.
Yes, I'm not sure if there's a question. I agree with you.
It was more of an answer, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, and I like the answer. I think back to where I was going, to go where Justice McCullough had gone in one of the earlier arguments today, one of the important things to remember is there is this very narrow issue before you today on the certified question from the Eastern District, but what you decide today obviously will impact further law. I think that really does caution the court not to create a duty and to recognize that drawing lines would be very difficult in this type of situation. There is no principled way that you can limit a duty, a take-home duty, without making arbitrary lines. And this court has said repeatedly that is not something that it does. And the public policy reasons also then weigh in favor of not recognizing a duty. The duty is not recognized under Virginia law. This court has never recognized a derivative duty. Therefore, the answer to the certified question should be no.
Thank you very much. You have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justice McCullough, I'd like to try to offer some thoughts about the overarching question of how to define duty within Virginia law and what the cases suggest on that. So in looking at all the cases, I see two different principles that come out quite clearly. And first I'll talk about the one that this case is not about. So in cases where the defendant has not created the risk that the plaintiff experiences, those are essentially rescue cases, or this court has sometimes called it passive negligence, or you can use the term nonfeasance, call it what you will, the defendant didn't create the risk. In those cases, this court has said that the existence of a duty depends upon a special relationship or a specific voluntary undertaking on the part of the defendant. Practically all of the defendant's cases that they cite in their brief are those types of cases, which are beside the point for what's in front of you today. Hollis, Jelt, Wade, even Dudley, where there was a duty, all of those are rescue cases. The core, leaving aside the rescue cases, the core of Virginia law is well stated in Standard Oil, which said it was a well-settled rule of the common law that a person who negligently uses a dangerous instrument or article under such circumstances that he has reason to know it's likely to produce injury is responsible for the natural and probable consequences of his act to any person injured. This is well fleshed out in Dudley in quoting the second restatement, section 281, which was mentioned earlier.
that we're dealing with conduct that creates a recognizable risk of harm to the other person individually or to a class of persons, as, for example, all persons within a given area of danger.
Counsel ended by saying this court has never recognized a derivative duty. Are you all arguing that this is a derivative duty? Is this a derivative duty?
No, Justice Powell, I don't see any reason to call this a derivative duty. The fact that there's an employment relationship concerned in it somewhere does not in any way make this a derivative duty. This is a duty that arises by virtue of the fact that the defendant's operations pose physical risks of harm on others. It is in that way no different from a case of release of toxins. My esteemed opposing counsel mentioned that the idea that a relational duty has to turn in some way on some relationship between time and space, and I don't think that this court's cases bear that out. Certainly there are certain types of risks, like the risk of a car accident, where the defendant and the plaintiff are going to be closely aligned in terms of time and space, but there are many other types of negligence where that isn't the case. A defendant that sends toxins into the air, there's not going to be a correspondence between time and space between the defendant's operations and the plaintiff's victimhood. A grocer who sends contaminated food out into the world, and then obviously product manufacturers that send negligent products out in the world, there's never going to be a correspondence between time and space there, and it doesn't matter because the question is about the relationship between the defendant's conduct and the risk that the plaintiff experiences.
Well,
that doesn't turn on geography or space or time.
Would that explain premises liability law? There's no doubt that a landowner's negligence could foreseeably injure a trespasser. But the law, for public policy reasons, and no reason to relitigate the point, but the law has always said, too bad. That class is beyond the relationship of duty, and it doesn't matter how utterly foreseeable it is. So it seems like everyone's making overstatements in this argument. It can't be simply what you say, which is what you do might hurt somebody, therefore you're liable in tort. It can't be that. A host of exceptions to that maxim are available.
Your Honor, those exceptions that you mentioned and the ones you've mentioned before, dram shop, doctor patient, landowner liability, those are all very, very long established special pockets of law within Virginia and within the common law as a whole. And to that extent, they may not conform to this general principle, but no one's asking them to. Defendants all agree with us that this is not a premises liability case, that principles of landowner liability don't apply here. And they don't because there are special pockets of the common law, which I'm not talking about in talking about these general principles. And this case does not fall into an established pocket. In Williamson versus the Old Rogue, this court said there's an established pocket of Virginia common law that deals with dram shop liability. That's why it's a matter for the legislature to look at this.
May I ask you this? There's some sparring, and particularly in the amicus briefs, about just how much the manufacturers and the users knew of the danger. And I take it that if we were to find a duty, and I have no idea what the court's going to do, but that the plaintiff would still have to prove that at trial. In other words, that the manufacturer had knowledge at the time that this kind of downstream exposure could lead to significant adverse effects. Am I correct about that?
Yes, you're right, Your Honor, if I may.
Answer any pending question.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, so because of the all of the elements that the plaintiff will bear the burden to prove at trial, including breach, including proximate cause, these questions of who knew what and when are absolutely going to be determined as questions for the jury. Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, thank you very much for your arguments. This session of the Supreme Court is now adjourned.